example, I would probably email, who did you call about getting the washing machine fixed? Even though some part of me knows it should be whom. You need to know your audience and what you're trying to get across. So far, a lot of the usage issues with pronouns that we've talked about a pronoun expanding its function in the system, which is really another way of looking at collapsing distinctions. Subject forms are taking on object functions, plural pronouns are taking on singular functions. We hit on agreement briefly with singular generic they as to whether they can refer back to a singular antecedent. Now, generic they can also come up a lot with indefinite pronouns like everyone, because everyone is semantically plural. Everyone should bring their receipts on Monday. So let's talk about indefinite pronouns, because they pose other agreement issues, especially the pronoun none. Let me return to the example from the end of the previous lecture. None of the books is, none of the books are. Indefinite pronouns as a class do not refer to a specific person or thing. They stand in for a vague or undetermined person or thing, or amount of things. You can see this when you look at examples of indefinite pronouns, things like anyone, anybody, everyone, someone, somebody, anything, everything, either, few, many. These are all indefinite pronouns. Most of these indefinite pronouns are straightforward in terms of agreement with verbs. Anyone is singular, anyone is, few is plural, few are. None is trickier, perhaps especially in a phrase where it is referring to none of a plural group of things. For example, none of my friends is, none of my friends are. We often will do both of those depending on context. And think about a sentence like, some of my friends are coming to visit this weekend, but none are getting here before Friday. We could say none is getting here before Friday, but I think it sounds much more colloquial to say none are getting here before Friday. So can none be both singular and plural? I'm going to ruin the punchline and say yes. We are often taught that none must be singular, and I was taught that, although our gut may want a plural verb here. And the rule itself seems to be bogus. And I will admit that I'm guilty of correcting student papers and making none singular when they have tried to make it plural. Lindley Murray put this rule in his 1795 grammar. And he first noted none's etymology, but he did this after saying none is used in both numbers, both singular and plural. And what Murray said about its etymology wasn't entirely accurate, because he said it was only singular in Old English, but in fact, in Old English, it has both singular and plural forms. That said, Murray noted that there was good authority for using none in the plural. The shame is that somewhere this got lost. By the late 19th century, this had become a hard and fast rule about none as a singular, and this still appears in some style guides. Luckily, other reputable usage guides recognize the singular and plural function of none and say that both the singular and plural can be standard. Brian Garner distinguishes usefully between the meaning of none as not one, where you should use the singular, and the meaning of none to mean not any, and there you would use the plural. I would say in conclusion that you are in good company if you use that as your guide. As we near the close of this lecture, let's review which pronouns we've covered. Personal pronouns, interrogative pronouns, and indefinite pronouns. We haven't covered another category of very common pronouns, namely this, that, these, and those. These are called demonstrative pronouns. They're pronouns that point at things, either inside the text or discourse or outside the text or discourse. And I want to address one usage issue related to this that comes up with academic writing. Did you learn that you should never leave a this by itself at the beginning of a sentence in formal writing? I did. And so I found that I was always trying to add a noun to refer back to whatever I was talking about. This idea, this reason, this point, this concept. And I have to say, this could get clunky. And notice what I just did there with this. And sometimes when I was trying to do it, it was hard to figure out what noun captured exactly what I was referring back to. Was it a hypothesis or a conjecture or an assertion? Now, the difference we're talking about here is this as a standalone pronoun and this as a determiner modifying a noun. The good news here, you can relax that stricture if you learned it. Sometimes it is okay to leave your this unattended, that is, without a noun next to it. The key is that it needs to be clear what you're referring back to. And it is okay, as Brian Garner puts it, if sometimes the this summarizes what I've just said. Let's look at one example from my bookshelf. I pulled down Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. He's making a connection between agriculture and growing seasons and educational reform. Here's what he writes. Unless a wheat or cornfield is left fallow every few years, the soil becomes exhausted. Every winter, fields are empty. The hard labor of spring planting and fall harvesting is followed, like clockwork, by the slower pace of summer and winter. This is the logic the reformers applied to the cultivation of young minds. Notice what Gladwell did there. He used this to refer back to everything he was saying about agriculture and the growing seasons. We knew exactly what he was talking about. There's an interesting study by John Swales, who's retired from the University of Michigan, about what happens with this in academic writing. And he looked at this every time it appeared at the beginning of a sentence in academic writing and found that a full one-third of those were unattended. In other words, you cannot say that published writers don't use unattended this. They use it about a third of the time. I would say that Brian Garner's advice is worth following here. Just make sure that you can answer the question, this what? The word that is even more complicated. It can be a demonstrative pronoun, a determiner, and a relative pronoun. The Microsoft Grammar Checker asks us to think about the relative pronoun every time it puts a green squiggly line under a that or a which, identifying it as somehow misused. Relative pronouns and what's going on with the Grammar Checker are complicated enough that they merit their own lecture. And so that is what we will do.
Lecture 7, Witch Hunting.
The Microsoft Word Grammar Checker has very strong feelings about the difference between that and which as relative pronouns. And it expresses those feelings in the green squiggly lines under our witches and thats. My informal polling of friends and coworkers at the university suggests that a good number of writers aren't entirely sure what the problem is with their witches and thats, but they change the that into a which, or more often the which into a that, until the grammar checker has been appeased. I would like everyone to have a better sense of what is going on here with those green squiggly lines. Let's look at an example that the grammar checker in Microsoft Word 2010 would flag. Here's the sentence. I have a great dress which you can borrow. The grammar checker wants a that here because it is a restrictive relative clause. It would allow which in a sentence with a non-restrictive relative clause, such as, I bought a great dress which happened to be on sale. Now let's back up. What is a relative clause? A relative clause is a clause that modifies a noun or a noun phrase, and in English it comes after that noun or noun phrase. So for example, the dress that I just bought. The man who wouldn't stop talking to me on the airplane. The relative clause is introduced by a relative pronoun that stands in for the noun being modified. The relative pronouns include that, which, who, whom, whoever, whomever and whose. Let me give you two more examples of sentences that have relative clauses in them. Here's one. I had lunch with a friend who just returned from China. Here you can see that the who subs in for a friend who just returned from China. And who just returned from China modifies a friend. Here's another sentence. Alex recently ran into our old roommate, who now lives in Hong Kong. Here we can see that the who subs in for our old roommate within the relative clause, and who now lives in Hong Kong all modifies our old roommate. In the two examples I've just given you, I have captured the restrictive, non-restrictive distinction again. And let me define those terms and then go back to the examples. A restrictive relative clause is a relative clause that narrows the set. It restricts the set to specify who or what I'm referring to in the sentence. A non-restrictive relative clause is a relative clause that adds additional information about the noun or noun phrase I'm referring back to, but the information I'm providing in the relative clause does not restrict the set. It's just additional information. With those definitions, let's go back to the two examples. I had lunch with a friend who just returned from China. Now, clearly, I have many, many friends. Of course I do. And what I'm trying to do here is restrict which friend I just had lunch with. I had lunch with a friend who just returned from China. So, who just returned from China is a restrictive relative clause because it specifies the friend that I am talking about here. Let's look at the second sentence. Alex recently ran into our old roommate, who now lives in Hong Kong. Here we need to imagine that there's just one roommate, and we all know who this roommate is. In that case, the relative clause, who now lives in Hong Kong, is just additional information that I'm providing about this roommate. It's already understood who the roommate is, and the non-restrictive clause just adds information about the roommate's whereabouts. It's interesting to note here that what we do in the written language as well is that with non-restrictives, who now lives in Hong Kong, we put a comma right before it. And that comma captures the pause that we would use in the spoken language. So let's look at two examples with restrictive and non-restrictive clauses with that and which. Here's the first one. I have the keys to the car that is in the driveway. Now, for this to work, we need to imagine a scenario in which I have multiple cars. I don't actually have multiple cars, but let's imagine I have multiple cars. And I'm specifying which car I'm talking about. I'm talking about the car that is in the driveway. That's the car I have the keys for, as opposed to the car that's in the garage or the car that's on the street. Here's another sentence. I have the keys to the car, which is in the driveway. In this scenario, there's only one car. You and I all know what car it is, and I'm just letting you know where the car is parked. The car happens to be in the driveway. This rule about that and which, where that is supposed to be used in restrictive relative clauses and which is supposed to be used in non-restrictive relative clauses, is an attempt to create complementary distribution where it may never have existed. For most speakers, that applies only to restrictive relative clauses. That sort of behaves itself, stays within that territory. And we tend not to use it after a comma for non-restrictives. So that, restrictives, we tend not to use it for non-restrictives. But a good number of us can use which for both. We can use it for non-restrictives, which is what the rule tells us to do, but we can also use it for restrictive relative clauses. For example, many of us can say, I have the keys to the car which is in the driveway. And in that sentence, it's when I'm trying to specify that it's the car which is in the driveway, not the car which is in the garage, or the car which is in the street. And you'll hear that there I used which in all three of those restrictive relative clauses. If you can get us to use which only for non-restrictives, and that's a big if, then there is no overlap. It's a very neat picture. The prescription about when to use that and when to use which in relative clauses can be traced back to H.W. Fowler's The King's English, published in 1908. But what you're going to notice is that it doesn't start as a clear-cut rule. Here's Fowler in 1908. This confusion, and he's talking about the confusion between that and which, this confusion is to be regretted. For although no distinction can be authoritatively drawn between the two relatives, an obvious one presents itself. I love that quote. He recognizes that there is not a clear-cut distinction, but he says, I can find one. He goes on to say that that should be used in defining restrictive relatives, and who or which in non-defining or non-restrictive relatives. He then adds, who or which should not be used in defining clauses, except when custom, euphony, or convenience is decidedly against the use of that. So we're starting to get the rule here about when to use that and when to use which or who. But Fowler is presenting it as an idealized distinction, as one that does not match reality, and allowing for exceptions based on euphony or convenience. Now, you may have noticed something else here that I want to note, which is that Fowler here is recommending that as the restrictive pronoun, both for animates and inanimates. And then he recommends who and which for non-restrictives. As you already know, I used to have a peeve about people using that with animates, as in the student that or the person that. And it's interesting to me to see Fowler prescribing that in those instances. As I mentioned before, I have no good grounds for my peeve, given the long history of that referring back to animate antecedents, and I have stopped marking it in student papers. It's also worth noting that most guides would now allow who to be used in restrictives. As you noted, Fowler puts that in restrictives for animates and inanimates. Now we would use who for restrictives with animates and for non-restrictives with animates. Fowler returns to the that-which distinction in his influential Grammar, a Dictionary of Modern English Usage. He clarifies his preference, and notice what I'm saying here, his preference for complementary distribution. And yet he shows his awareness that actual usage and his preferred order of things do not necessarily align. He starts by acknowledging that grammarians have less influence on usage than they may realize. And I think that that's worth noting. And he goes on to say that even though he realizes they may not have influence, it can be hard to resist having preferences about what would be the best usage. He then notes, and here I'm going to quote Fowler, the relations between that, who, and which have come to us from our forefathers as an odd jumble and plainly show that the language has not been neatly constructed by a master builder who could create each part to do the exact work required of it, neither overlapped nor overlapping. So Fowler accepts the jumble, but he says it doesn't mean that we couldn't, at least theoretically, do better. He explains, and again here I'll quote, if writers would agree to regard that as the defining relative pronoun and which as the non-defining, there would be much gain both in lucidity and in ease. Some there are who follow this principle now, but it would be idle to pretend that it is the practice either of most or of the best writers. So Fowler recognizes that good usage, as practiced by the best writers, does not always follow the rule that he is proposing. The jumble that Fowler describes gets lost in Strunk and White's version of the rule. When they write, about this in Elements of Style, they make a very clear distinction. They say that is restrictive and which is non-restrictive. But they do then note that there are exceptions, such as this sentence from the Bible. Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which has come to pass. This thing which has come to pass. We see the which there in a restrictive relative clause. But I have to say that the exception that Strunk and White seem to allow, again, based on euphony, perhaps convenience, doesn't seem to be an option for most of us. Because in the end, they tell us to go witch hunting, to go look for all our witches and change the ones that need to be changed to that to improve our work. We find similarly definitive advice in lots of other places. The Associated Press style book, for example, makes no exceptions to the restrictive and non-restrictive rule. Brian Garner's A Dictionary of English Usage, the first edition published in 1998, is worth quoting in full on this. And this is a pretty long quote, but it's a really interesting one. So here's Garner. You'll encounter two schools of thought on this point. First are those who don't care about any distinction between these words, who think that witch is more formal than that, and who point to many historical examples of copious witches. They say that modern usage is a muddle. Second are those who insist that both words have useful functions that ought to be separated, and who observe the distinction rigorously in their own writing. They view departures from this distinction as mistakes. Before reading any further, you ought to know something more about these two groups. Those in the first probably don't write very well. Those in the second just might. So that was Garner on that and which. And I have to say, that is pretty strong language about people who use that and which interchangeably in restrictive clauses to suggest that those folks may not be good writers, whereas the folks who observe the distinction are. The idea seems to be that if you follow this rule about that and which, you are detail-oriented as a writer and care about the niceties. I'm not sure that is fair given the history of the jumble. It may mean, if you're observing that distinction, that you have a good editor who's in there fixing things for you. Now, the American Heritage Dictionary usage note on this takes a more tempered tone. The editors note that which with restrictive relative clauses is common. And they note that it may be preferable if there is a that in the antecedent noun phrase. Let me show you what I mean, and you'll hear why you might want to use a which here. Here's a sentence. We want to assign only that material which will be most helpful. We want to assign only that material which will be most helpful. So it's a restrictive clause, but we use which. Let's see what happens if we use that. We only want to assign that material that will be most helpful. And you get those two that's very close to each other. May not sound so good. Now, the Microsoft Word grammar checker, let's return to the grammar checker, suggests with that green squiggly line that you are making an error if you use which in a restrictive relative clause. If you look it up in the grammar checker, you will see that this issue of that and which is put into the category of style errors, and it's called a questionable use of that and which. But I have to say that I think when people see the green squiggly line, that does not suggest that this is questionable. It suggests that if you're using which in a restrictive relative clause, you've made a mistake. After this discussion, I hope that you now have a more complicated picture about what's going on with that green squiggly line and about this so-called rule about that and which. Let's now talk about a couple of other features of relative clauses. The first that I want to talk about is clauses introduced by a zero relative. And the second one that I want to talk about is something called pied piping, which involves moving the preposition that's connected to the relative pronoun up to the front of the relative clause. I've grouped these two constructions together because both zero relatives and pied piping involve relative clauses with a relative pronoun in object position. Okay, I know that this is going to get nitty gritty here, but it's why you're here. So let me explain each of these in turn. Let's start with zero relatives. In these relative clauses, the relative pronoun does not appear at all. Let me show you what I mean. Let's take the sentence, let me lend you the book that I just finished. Let me lend you the book that I just finished. Well, in that sentence, we can omit the relative pronoun and get, let me lend you the book I just finished. See, that is gone, is just gone. Let me lend you the book I just finished. Let me give you another example. First, we'll do it with the relative pronoun. I can't remember the name of the person whom I met last night. I can't remember the name of the person whom I met last night. But we could just get rid of that whom. I can't remember the name of the person I met last night. The whom is gone. Now, this zero relative where we omit the relative pronoun can only happen when the relative pronoun functions as the object of the relative clause. Let me show you what is happening in these relative clauses. Let's take the first example I gave you about lending the book that I just finished, where the relative clause here is that I just finished. If we put the relative pronoun that back into where it would be as the object of the relative clause, we would get, I just finished that book, right? I just finished that. But the relative pronoun doesn't get to stay in object position in the relative clause. The object relative pronoun gets fronted up to the beginning of the relative clause, up next to the noun that it modifies. So we get a relative clause, we get the book, and then the relative clause, again, I'm going to keep that in object position. The book, I just finished that. But then we move the that up and we get the book that I just finished. So yes, as you may have noticed, the object pronoun there in the relative clause gets moved up in front of the subject, that I just finished. And once you've done that, you can delete the book I just finished. Let's review that again by looking at the other sentence. The sentence was, I can't remember the name of the person whom I met last night. Again, let's put the relative pronoun back into object position in the relative clause. If we do that, we would take whom I met last night and turn it into I met whom last night, right? Because whom, I put it into that object position. But again, whom doesn't get to stay there in the relative clause. It gets fronted in the relative clause. And so the person, I met whom last night, the whom gets fronted and we get the person whom I met last night. Once whom is up there, you can delete it and you can get the person I met last night. Now, when the relative pronoun is the subject of the relative clause, it's already up there in the front of the relative clause. Let me show you what I mean. Let's take another sentence. I saw my friend who lives in Beijing. I saw my friend who lives in Beijing. Here we've got my friend who lives in Beijing. Who lives in Beijing is the relative clause, and who is in subject position, who lives in Beijing. Given that, it's already at the head of the relative clause. It doesn't have to get fronted. It has nowhere to go. And when that relative pronoun is in subject position, we cannot omit it. We cannot have a zero relative. So again, let's look at that sentence. I saw my friend who lives in Beijing. Just try omitting the who and see what happens. I saw my friend lives in Beijing. It just doesn't work. I saw my friend lives in Beijing. But when that relative pronoun is an object position, when it's an object relative pronoun, we can omit it. Go back to my sentence. I can't remember the name of the person I met last night. Now, it's probably possible to omit that relative pronoun in object position because it's still easy to parse the sentence. The noun person is followed by another noun, the person I met last night. So your brain knows that some new grammatical structure is starting right now. Okay, because you're getting one noun next to another. The person I met last night. And so we can omit the relative. But when it's in subject position, our brain clearly struggles somehow. Remember the sentence, I saw my friend lives in Beijing. And part of that may be that when you get my friend lives in Beijing, it seems like we've started another clause right there, and it's fairly difficult to process. The option of deleting the relative pronoun in these constructions, I have to say, is really convenient when you're dealing with who and whom. You may have noticed that in my example sentence, I was talking about the person, I can't remember their name, I can't remember the name of the person whom I met last night. Now, I have to say, in colloquial speech, that's not what I would say. I would say, I can't remember the name of the person who I met last night. But some people would think that I don't know my who's from my whom's, and the easy thing is just to omit the relative pronoun entirely. It gets you out of the conundrum. And just say, I can't remember the name of the person I met last night. And you don't have to deal with who or whom. And as we've talked about before, that whom can sound very formal, if not sometimes even a little pretentious. So just a quick review with who and whom. You would, at least in theory, always get a whom when the relative pronoun functions as the object in the relative clause. It then gets bumped up to the front of the relative clause, which makes it harder to recognize as the object. Right? Because once it's up front, it sort of looks like a subject. Let me show you what I mean. Here's a sentence. She's the colleague whom we recommended for the award. That whom has gotten bumped up to the front of the relative clause. It would be very tempting to say instead, even though the whom is technically correct, she's the colleague who we recommended for the award. And as I said, you can avoid the whole issue by saying, she's the colleague we recommended for the award. Let's now turn to pied piping. This is what happens when the relative pronoun is the object of a preposition in the relative clause. And it also happens in nominal clauses. Let me give you an example. I am wondering whom I should send the RSVP to. I'm wondering whom I should send the RSVP to. Or, I'm wondering to whom I should send the RSVP. Both come from a, if we undo this, we get, I'm wondering I should send the RSVP to whom, right? I'm wondering, and then if we take the clause and put the whom back with its preposition, I should send the RSVP to whom. But that whom gets fronted. So then the question is, what happens to that preposition? Grammatically, it can stay there at the end of the sentence. We'll come back to the rule about whether or not you can strand those at the end of a sentence in lecture 18. But if we're thinking descriptively, the preposition can stay at the end of the sentence. Or we can front it too. This is what's called pied piping, because the preposition is following the relevant pronoun up to the front of the relevant clause, just like the children were following the pied piper. And I absolutely love this term to describe this phenomenon. Now, pied piping can feel very formal when you say, to whom should I send the RSVP, as opposed to who should I send the RSVP to? Now, here's an oddity of English syntax, and I just can't resist telling you about this. This is what happens when we are not using a whom, but we're using a that as the object of the preposition. Consider this sentence. She read the book that I referred to. She read the book that I referred to. If we decide to pied pipe that preposition, the that must turn into a which. She read the book to which I referred. She read the book to which I referred. So you would have that, she read the book that I referred to, but front the to, and suddenly that becomes a which. Why? Because English syntax is full of idiosyncrasies like that. This seems completely normal to us, and you may never have thought about it, but it also, I think, confirms that the that-which distinction is a bit of a muddle. While we're talking about oddities, here's another one with relative pronouns. As a general rule, we restrict who and whom to animate beings. Can we then say who is only used for animate? No. There is an exception. We have this odd gap in the language for how to handle possessive relative pronouns for inanimate objects. An example will help here. Here's an example sentence. I return the computer whose hard drive is broken. I return the computer whose hard drive is broken. Suddenly we've got a whose referring back to the computer. Or here's another one. The car whose horn is blaring is driving me crazy. The car whose horn. We can use that, the car that horn is blaring, but whose is also accepted as completely standard. And I have to say it often sounds better than of which, if you can even use of which in some of those sentences at all. Where do animals fall into this inanimate distinction with who versus that and which? Let's end with that question. I don't actually think this is about a grammatical rule at all. I think this is more about how you feel about the animals in question. I did a search of the corpus of contemporary American English on this, and I searched for the dog that versus the dog who. And the dog that was more than twice as common as the dog who. I got the same thing when I searched for cats and elephants and turtles. We tend to use that when we're talking about animals in general. The cat that ate the canary. We're more likely to use who when we're talking about a specific animal, perhaps a specific cat about whom we have strong personal feelings. And since we're speaking of pets, I'm going to start the next lecture on determiners by sharing a pet peeve of mine. A peeve of historic proportions, so to speak. Okay, so that was a very bad play on the word pet to transition to the next lecture. But I have given you a historic hint about my pet peeve.
Lecture 8, an historical issue.
It's been a few lectures since I confessed to a usage peeve. So this seemed like a good time. Here's one. It grates on me just a little bit when people say an historical novel or an historic event. Now, if these people are H-droppers, and that's actually a technical linguistic term, H-dropping or H-droppers, people who drop the H at the beginning of a word, if these people are H-droppers and are H-droppers with the word historical, and say historical, it doesn't bother me at all. They would say an historical novel. But if these folks pronounce that initial H in historical, it sounds odd and maybe even affected to me to say an historical. I hear it all over the university, and I notice it every time. What's going on here? A and an are indefinite articles, used with countable nouns, like historical novels and historic events. The rule is that you put A before consonants and an before vowels. That is something we all learned at a young age. A cat, an elephant. So why would we say a unicorn? I once put this on a final exam in one of my classes, and I got fascinating responses to this. Including, it is a unicorn because unicorns are mythical beings and they defy the rules of English grammar. It's a great answer, but it's not actually the answer to this question. We say a unicorn because though unicorn is spelled with an initial vowel, if you listen to how we pronounce it, it is pronounced with a y at the beginning, unicorn, and y is a consonant. This also explains why we say an hour, because hour is spelled with an initial H, but pronounced with an initial vowel. So what's going on with the words history and historical? Well, you'll notice in those two words the stress shift. History, stress on the first syllable, historical, stress on the second syllable. Because the stress is on the first syllable in history, it's more likely that the H will be pronounced in history. for people who drop the H, they may be more likely to drop it in historical, although they can drop it in both. But many of us pronounce the H in both history and historical. This issue of ahistorical versus anhistorical has been addressed in usage guides. And you might be surprised what the guides say about this, because high usage, from what I can tell at the university, in the academy, is often anhistorical. Here's H.W. Fowler in his Dictionary of Modern English Usage from 1926. He notes that the H is now usually pronounced in words like historical, which, as he notes, starts with an unaccented syllable. It has not always been the case that that H was consistently pronounced, but Fowler says now it is. And then he writes, now that the H in such words is pronounced, the distinction has become pedantic, and ahistorical should be said and written. The AP Style Book and the Chicago Manual of Style both recommend ahistoric and ahistorical. When did this shift? When did we start saying ahistorical rather than anhistorical? From what I can tell, ahistorical starts to be used regularly in the early 19th century. By 1900, a and an, ahistorical and anhistorical, are used with about equal frequency in writing. It's in the late 1930s, early 1940s, when we see what I'll call the crossover, when we start to see ahistorical become more common than anhistorical. At this point, if you search the Google Books Ngram viewer, you will find that ahistorical is more than twice as common as anhistorical. The site Grammarist, that website, calls anhistoric an unnecessary affectation. And Maeve Maddox, on the website dailywritingtips.com, she looks at comment sections online and notes that there is a lot of vitriol about this question, including this quote, when people use anhistorical on NPR, it is because they're snooty. As you know, I'm one of the people who noticed this, and I find it a little bit exaggerated. But I also try to check myself and not be too judgmental about it. I think it is very useful to step back and remember that in the end, all we're talking about here is the presence or absence of one consonant, A versus an. What we see here is how loaded even the smallest language choices can become. They can get you judged as snooty, or in other cases as uneducated or illiterate. Remember the harsh language we talked about with less on grocery store signs. With that introduction about a and an, let's talk about determiners more generally as a lexical class. A and an, as indefinite articles, both fall in the broader category of determiners, and determiners will be the focus of the rest of this lecture. Determiners often don't get that much attention, but here in this course, everything gets attention. Determiners are the little words that introduce nouns to create noun phrases. In this lecture, we'll focus on three things: the highly intuitive rules that govern the ordering of determiners, then some regional differences in usage, and finally, at the end of the lecture, we'll talk about some issues of capitalization in noun phrases that include determiners, for example, the president versus President Lincoln. The category of determiners is bigger than many people realize, and there isn't a lot of agreement about how to categorize them. Let's think about this as a set of little words and look at just one way we can subdivide the set. Here's one version with seven major categories. I've created an acronym for this, PI and IQ. You may be able to do better, but that's what I came up with. So PI and IQ. The P is for possessives. These are determiners like my, her, their, our. I, interrogatives. Which, what, whatever. A, articles. A, and the. N, numbers. These would be the cardinal and the ordinal numbers. So things like 1 and 2, as well as 1st and 2nd. D, demonstratives. This, that, these, those. I, indefinites. Any, each, other, another. Q, quantifiers. Many, some, several, most. But I have to say, we can categorize them this way and that's helpful, but it doesn't strike me as the most interesting thing to think about with all these different kinds of determiners. We can also subdivide this set into three categories based on the order in which they occur in a noun phrase. Predeterminers, central determiners, postdeterminers. And those terms are really about the order in which they occur. Predeterminers happen before central determiners. Postdeterminers happen after central determiners. It is true that the central determiners have some of the most common determiners, like a, an, and the. Now, thinking about determiners this way in terms of the order is interesting to me because it captures the rules we don't get credit for knowing. We've talked about this before with some usage issues, and it really comes into play here because I would guess many of you have never thought about the order in which these determiners have to occur. Let me give you two examples. The first several pages. All my many quirks. We wouldn't say the several first pages. We just wouldn't. We would say the first several pages. We also wouldn't say my all many quirks. We would say all my many quirks. How do we know this? It's the kind of intuitive knowledge that makes up a lot of descriptive grammar. And I want to note that there has been, over the years, some prescription on this, not a lot, but some, that now won't feel very intuitive at all. John McWhorter has noted that in the late 1800s, there was an argument that it should be the two first people, not the first two people. Unless, of course, you were referring to the first pair of people who arrived, in which case you could say the first two people because those two people came together, but otherwise you would say the two first people. Now, clearly, the prescriptivists who were fighting that fight did not win. Let's now go through how the determiners sort into these categories of predeterminer, central determiner, and postdeterminer. And this is, again, based on the order in which they appear in the noun phrase. So predeterminers, the ones that will come first, would include things like all and both, multiplying expressions and fractions, so words like twice or half. These predeterminers don't tend to co-occur. You'll tend to get only one of them. Then you get the central determiners. This includes definite and indefinite articles, so a, an, and the, possessives, and demonstratives. Then you have postdeterminers. This can include the cardinal and the ordinal numbers, general ordinals like next and last, as well as quantifiers, many or some. Now, these postdeterminers can co-occur. For example, we can say the next few meetings, but we would not say the few next meetings. Why? Because. Let's pause for a moment here to clarify how determiners are different from adjectives as well as from pronouns. As we've talked about before, adjectives are open class. We can add new adjectives somewhat at will. Determiners are closed class. They're function words, and we don't tend to get new ones very often at all. Adjectives can occur before a noun. They also can occur out in the predicate. As an example, the friendly cat. So they're friendly, the adjective occurs before the noun. I don't know why I'm talking about friendly cats, but I am, and I'm going to keep going. So we have the friendly cat, friendly before the noun. We can also say the cat is friendly. There the adjective has moved out into the predicate. But determiners only appear before the noun within the noun phrase. So we get the cat and not cat is the. adjectives will consistently fall between the determiners and the noun. So we would have all our cats, where we have two determiners, all our cats. If we put in an adjective, we get all our friendly cats. We would not have all friendly our cats. Just doesn't work that way. Adjectives can also be modified by intensifiers such as very, very friendly. We would not say very the. Adjectives usually take comparatives and superlatives. So we could say more friendly or friendlier, but we can't say more the or the-er. You can now see why sometimes people take the word few and categorize it as an adjective, because you can say very few and fewer, but you'll also see few categorized as a determiner. So that's the difference between determiners and adjectives. Let's now look at determiners compared with pronouns. Many of the words that function as determiners can also function as pronouns. The key here is whether the word is standing alone in place of a noun phrase, as opposed to modifying a noun. To look at this, let's start with many. It's the difference between the sentence, many clichés have some wisdom in them. In that sentence, many is a determiner. Many clichés have some wisdom in them. But let's imagine we're having a conversation about clichés, and I say, many have some wisdom in them. There, many is a pronoun because it's standing on its own to substitute for the noun phrase. Many have some wisdom in them. Let's take another example. I say, I read a few good books this summer. There, few is a determiner. I read a few good books this summer. But let's imagine that you ask me, did you read any good books? And I say, I read a few this summer. There, few is a noun, substituting in for the pronoun, for the noun phrase. The possessives in terms, we think about determiners versus pronouns, the possessives change form. So the determiner, for example, is my. The pronoun is mine, because mine can stand alone. Mine is blue. Our becomes ours. Your as a determiner becomes yours as a pronoun. Her, hers, their, theirs. The only ones that don't change are the determiners that already end in S. His remains his, and its remains its. As a result, if we say my friend with the determiner my, it becomes a friend of mine with the pronoun mine in what is a double possessive, a friend of mine with of and mine. We'll come back to that in lecture 23 when we talk about possessives and apostrophes. It is worth noting here that the determiners the, a, and an cannot be made pronouns. So now we have defined determiners and how they work within the noun phrase. Let's look briefly at a few cases of regional variation, one of which is well known to Americans and one of which might not be. Let's start with an American-British distinction. If we're speaking generically, in British English, one goes to hospital, or one is in hospital. In American English, one goes to the hospital, or is in the hospital, even though it's not a specific hospital. It's just a generic hospital. And there are people who say, why do we have this distinction? Why do the Brits say in hospital and we say in the hospital here in the United States? I don't have a great answer to that, but it is worth noting that Americans in other places speak about things generically without the determiner the. For example, Americans go to church, not to the church generically. Americans go to prison and to college. It's the difference between going to prison or to college in general, to anyone, versus going to the prison to visit. There we have a specific prison in mind, we're going to visit. We're going to the school to visit, as opposed to going to school in general. Now here's another regional distinction that you may not be aware of. I wasn't aware of it until I moved to the state of Michigan. I moved to Michigan when I was in graduate school, and in the first few weeks of graduate school, my fellow graduate students would sometimes talk about going to the bar. They would say, "Tonight we'll go to the bar." And I have to say, I felt pretty left out because it seemed to me that they had all agreed on some bar, and they all knew what bar they were going to, and so they were going to the bar, the one they all knew about. And somehow nobody had told me about what bar it was. Poor me. But what I learned was that in Michigan, going to the bar is generic. It's what I would say as going to a bar. But in Michigan, you go to the bar. Who knows where you're going? You'll decide that later. Now, we may not all agree in the end on a bar versus the bar. But we can all agree that the bar there is not capitalized, unless there's a bar called the bar with a capital T and a capital B, and that's just confusing. To close this lecture, let's look at a capitalization issue that can come up when we think about determiners. This is the capitalization of nouns like president. If we're talking about a president in general, it's clearly not capitalized. And when we refer to the current president, it is capitalized. So for example, let's imagine it's 1978. We would say President Carter with a capital P, and obviously Carter is capitalized. But what about when you refer to the president of the United States, and there is it the president lowercase p, or the president capital P, if we're talking about the current president? We're not naming that president by name, but we all know who we're talking about. So we don't say President Carter, we just say the president. Capitalized or not? I have to say, this is one of those usage issues that comes up a lot and people send me queries about it. To answer this about current rules for capitalization, I need to note that capitalization has been a moving target in the history of English. Our current rules about when to capitalize and when not to capitalize are relatively recent and, to some extent, still in flux. So let me go back in time a little bit. In the Renaissance, we find a good amount of variation in terms of which nouns might get capitalized and which might not. And this can happen in the middle of a sentence. Sometimes nouns get capitalized just for emphasis. By the 17th century, capitalization was settling down so that a word, for example, would always be capitalized at the beginning of a sentence. That was not always a given, I have to note. Words would be capitalized in proper names, in the word I, and in important nouns like titles and personified nouns. This is a period of time where nouns like virtue were often capitalized. The 18th century witnessed an increased use of capitalization, and in this case it was for nouns that were deemed important, for things like fields of study, for example, rhetoric. Ben Franklin was actually quite fond of this practice of capitalizing nouns, and you can see it in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence. Let me show you what I mean. Here's an excerpt from the U.S. Constitution. No, capital N, person, capital P, except a natural-born citizen, capital C, or a citizen, capital C, of the United States is capitalized, at the time of the adoption, capital A, of this Constitution, capital C, shall be eligible to the office, capital O, of President, capital P. Now, if that were getting rewritten today, a lot of those nouns would not be capitalized, but in the Constitution they are. Here's an excerpt from the Declaration of Independence. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, capital L, our fortunes, capital F, and our sacred honor, capital H. when we see texts that have these kinds of patterns of capitalization, I think we just recognize them as older, but I'm not sure we always connect them to the ongoing concerns about capitalization. In the second half of the 18th century, grammarians started to clamp down on this use of capital letters for